She did not. No, they couldn't just do this to her. They might think they could sweep her away like rubbish, but she didn't have to lie down and take it. She had come from nothing. She wasn't going back to nothing. The courtyard doors opened as class let out. Her classmates hurried past her, pretending they didn't see her. Only Kitai hung behind. "June will come around," he said. Rin took his proffered hand and stood up in silence. She wiped at her face with her sleeve and sniffed.
"I mean it," Kitai said.
He placed a hand on her shoulder.
"He only suspended Najah for a week."
She shrugged his hand off violently, still wiping furiously at her eyes. "That's because Najah was born with a gold ingot in his mouth. Najah got off because his father's got half the faculty here by their balls. Najah's from Synegard, so Najah's special. Najah belongs here."
"Come on, you belong here too. You passed the Kudju."
"The Kudju doesn't mean anything," Rin said scathingly. "The Kudju is a ruse to keep uneducated peasants right where they've always been. You slip past the Kudju, they'll find a way to expel you anyway. The Kudju keeps the lower classes sedated. It keeps us dreaming. It's not a ladder for mobility. It's a way to keep people like me exactly where they were born. The Kudju is a drug."
"Rin, that's not true."
"It is!" She slammed her fist against the wall. "But they're not going to get rid of me like this. Not this easily. I won't let them. I won't." She swayed suddenly. Her vision pulsed black and then cleared.
"Great tortoise," said Kitai. "Are you all right?"
She whirled on him. "What are you talking about?"
"You're sweating."
"Sweating?" She wasn't sweating. "I'm fine," she said. Her voice sounded inordinately loud. It rang in her ears. Was she shouting?
"Rin, calm down."
"I'm calm! I'm extremely calm!" She was far from fucking calm. She wanted to hit something. She wanted to scream at someone. Anger pulsed through her like a wave of heat. Then her stomach erupted with a pain like she had been stabbed. She gasped sharply and clutched at her midriff. She felt as if someone were sliding a jagged stone through her innards. Kitai grasped at her shoulders.
"Rin? Rin?"
She felt the sudden urge to vomit. Had Najah's blows given her internal damage? "Oh, fantastic," she thought. "Now you're humiliated and injured, too. Wait until they watch you limp into class. Najah's going to love that." She shoved Kitai away. "I don't need... Leave me alone!"
"But you're... I'm fine!"
Rin awoke that night to a deeply confusing, sticky sensation. Her sleeping pants felt cold, the way her pants had felt when she'd been little and peed in her sleep. But her legs were too sticky to be covered in urine. Heart pounding, she scrambled out of her bunk and lit a lamp with shaking fingers. She glanced down at herself and almost shrieked out loud. The soft candlelight illuminated pools of crimson everywhere. She was covered in an enormous amount of blood. She fought to still her panic, to force her drowsy mind to think rationally. She felt no acute pain, only a deep discomfort and great irritation. She hadn't been stabbed. She hadn't somehow ejected all of her inner organs. A fresh flow of blood trickled down her leg that moment, and she traced it to the source with soaked fingers. Then she was just confused. Going back to sleep was out of the question. She wiped herself off with the parts of the sheet that weren't soaked in blood, jammed a piece of cloth between her legs, and ran out of the dormitory to get to the infirmary before the rest of the campus woke. Rin reached the infirmary in a sweaty, bloody mess, halfway to a nervous breakdown. The physician on call took one look at her and called his female assistant over.
"One of those situations," he said.
"Of course." The assistant looked like she was trying hard not to laugh. Rin did not see anything remotely funny about the situation. The assistant took Rin behind a curtain, handed her a change of clothes and a towel, and then sat her down with a detailed diagram of the female body. It was a testament, perhaps, to the lack of sexual education in Takani that Rin didn't learn about menstruation until that morning. Over the next 15 minutes, the physician's assistant explained in detail the changes going on in Rin's body, pointing to various places on the diagram and making some very vivid gestures with her hands.
"So you're not dying, sweetheart. Your body is just shedding your uterine lining."
Rin's jaw had been hanging open for a solid minute.
"What the fuck?"
She returned to the bunks with a deeply uncomfortable girdle strapped under her pants and a sock filled with heated uncooked rice grains. She placed the sock on her lower torso to dull the aching pain, but the cramping was so bad that she couldn't crawl out of bed before classes started.
"Do you want me to get someone?"
Niang asked.
"No," Rin mumbled. "I'm fine. Just go." She lay in bed for the entire day, despairing at all the class she was missing.
"I'll be all right."
She chanted it over and over to herself so that she wouldn't panic. One missed day couldn't hurt. Pupils got sick all the time. Kitai would lend her his notes if she asked. Surely she could catch up. But this was going to happen every month. Every goddamned month her uterus would tear itself to pieces, send flashes of rage through her entire body, and make her bloated, clumsy, lightheaded, and worst of all, weak. No wonder women rarely remained at Synegard. She needed to fix this problem. If only it weren't so deeply embarrassing. She needed help. Venka seemed like someone who would have already begun menstruating, but Rin would have died rather than ask her how she'd managed it. Instead, she mumbled her questions to Kirill one night after she was sure Nyang and Venka had gone to sleep. Kirill laughed out loud in the darkness.
"Just wear the girdle to class. You'll be fine. You get used to the cramping."
"But how often do I have to change it? What if it leaks in class? What if it gets on my uniform? What if someone sees?"
"Calm down," said Kirill. "The first time is hard, but you'll adapt to it. Keep track of your cycle, then you'll know when it's coming on."
This wasn't what Rin wanted to hear.
"There's no way to just stop it forever?"
"Not unless you cut out your womb,"
Kirill scoffed, then paused at the look on Rin's face.
"I was kidding. That's not actually possible."
"It's possible."
Arda, who was a medicine apprentice, interrupted them quietly.
"There's a procedure they offer at the infirmary. At your age, it wouldn't even require open surgery. They'll give you a concoction. It'll stop the process pretty much indefinitely."
"Seriously?"
Hope flared in Rin's chest. She looked between the two apprentices.
"Well, what's stopping you from taking it?"
They both looked at her incredulously.
"It destroys your womb," Arda said finally. "Basically kills one of your inner organs. You won't be able to have children after."
"And it hurts like a bitch," Kirill said. "It's not worth it."
"But I don't want children," Rin thought. "I want to stay here."
If that procedure could stop her menstruating, if it could help her remain at Synegard, it was worth it. Once her bleeding stopped, Rin went back to the infirmary and told the physician what she wanted. He did not argue with her. In fact, he seemed pleased.
"I've been trying to convince the girls here to do this for years," he said. "None of them listen. Small wonder so few of you make it past your first year. They should make this mandatory."
He made her wait while he disappeared into the back room, mixing together the requisite medicines. 10 minutes later, he returned with a steaming cup.
"Drink this."
Rin took the cup. It was dark porcelain, so she couldn't tell the color of the liquid inside. She wondered if she should feel anything,
This was significant, wasn't it? There would be no children for her. No one would agree to marry her after this. Shouldn't that matter? No. No, of course not. If she'd wanted to grow fat with squealing brats, she would have stayed in Takani. She had come to Synegard to escape that future. Why hesitate now? She searched herself for any twinge of regret. Nothing. She felt absolutely nothing. Just as she had felt nothing the day she left Takani, watching the dusty town recede forever into the distance.
"It'll hurt," the physician warned. "Much worse than it hurt when you were menstruating. Your womb will self-destruct over the next few hours. After this, it will stop fulfilling its function. When your body has matured fully, you can get a surgery to have your womb removed altogether, but this should solve your problem in the interim. You'll be out of class for at least a week after this, but afterward, you'll be free forever. Now, I'm required to ask you one more time if you're certain this is what you want."
"I'm certain." Rin didn't want to think it over anymore. She held her breath and lifted the mug to her mouth, wincing at the taste. The physician had added honey to mask the bitterness, but the sweetness only made it more horrible. It tasted the way that opium smelled. She had to swallow many times before she drained the entire mug. When she finished, her stomach felt numb and weirdly sated, bloated and rubbery. After a few minutes, an odd prickling feeling tingled at the base of her torso, like someone was poking her with tiny needles from inside.
"Get back to your room before it starts to hurt," the physician advised. "I'll tell the masters you're ill. The nurse will check on you tonight. You won't want to eat, but I'll have one of your classmates bring you some food just in case."
Rin thanked him and ran with a wobbling gait back to her quarters, clutching her abdomen. The prickling had turned into an acute pain spreading across her lower stomach. She felt as if she had swallowed a knife and it was twisting in a slow circle inside her. Somehow she made it back to her bed. "Pain is just a message," she told herself. She could choose to ignore it. She could. It was terrible. She whimpered aloud. She did not sleep so much as lie in a fevered daze. She turned deliriously on the sheets, dreaming of unborn, misshapen infants, of Toby digging his five claws into her stomach.
"Rin! Rin?"
Someone hovered over her. It was Nyang, bearing a wooden bowl.
"I brought you some winter melon soup."
Nyang knelt down beside Rin and held the bowl to her face. Rin took one whiff of the soup. Her stomach seized painfully.
"I'm good," she said weakly. "There's also this sedative."
Nyang pushed a cup toward her.
"The physician said it's safe for you to take it now if you want to, but you don't have to." "Are you joking? Give me that!"
Rin grabbed the cup and guzzled it down. Immediately her head began to swim. The room became delightfully fuzzy. The stabbing in her abdomen disappeared. Then something rose up in the back of her throat. Rin lunged to the side of the bed and vomited into the basin she had set there. Blood splattered the porcelain. She glanced down at the basin with a deranged satisfaction. Better to get the blood out this way, she thought. All at once, rather than slowly, every month, for years. While she continued to retch, she heard the door to the dormitory open. Someone walked inside and paused in front of her.
"You're insane," said Venka.
Rin glared up at her, blood dripping from her mouth, and smiled. Rin spent 4 delirious days in bed before she could return to class. When she did drag herself out of bed, against both Nyang's and the physician's recommendations, she found she was hopelessly behind. She had missed an entire unit on Mugini verb conjugations in linguistics, the chapter on the demise of the Red Emperor in history,
Sun Tzu's analysis of geographical forecasting and strategy, and the finer points of setting a splint in medicine. She expected no lenience from the masters and received none. The masters treated her like missing class was her fault. And it was. She had no excuses. She could only accept the consequences. She flubbed questions every time a master called on her. She scored at the bottom of every exam. She didn't complain. For the entire week, she endured the master's condescension in silence. Oddly, she didn't feel discouraged, but rather as if a veil had been lifted. Her first few weeks at Synegard had been like a dream. Dazzled by the magnificence of the city and the academy, she had allowed herself to drift. She had now been painfully reminded that her place here was not permanent. The Kudju had meant nothing. The Kudju had tested her ability to recite poems like a parrot. Why had she ever imagined that might have prepared her for a school like Synegard? But if the Kudju had taught her anything, it was that pain was the price of success. And she hadn't burned herself in a long time. She had grown content at the academy. She had grown lazy. She had lost sight of what was at stake. She had needed to be reminded that she was nothing, that she could be sent back home at a moment's notice, that as miserable as she was at Synegard, what awaited her in Takani was much, much worse. He looks at you and licks his lips. He brings you to the bed. He forces a hand between your legs. You scream, but no one hears you. She would stay. She would stay at Synegard even if it killed her. She threw herself into her studies. Classes became like warfare, each interaction a battle. With every raised hand and every homework assignment, she competed against Nerja and Benka and every other Synegardian. She had to prove that she deserved to be kept on, that she merited further training. She had needed failure to remind her that she wasn't like the Synegardians. She hadn't grown up speaking casual Hesperian, wasn't familiar with the command structure of the Imperial Militia, didn't know the political relationships between the 12 warlords like the back of her hand. The Synegardians had this knowledge ingrained from childhood. She would have to develop it. Every waking hour that she didn't spend in class, she spent in the archives. She read the assigned texts out loud to herself, wrapping her tongue around the unfamiliar Synegardian dialect until she had eradicated all hints of her southern drawl. She began to burn herself again. She found release in the pain. It was comforting. Familiar. It was a trade-off she was well used to. Success required sacrifice. Sacrifice meant pain. Pain meant success. She stopped sleeping. She sat in the front row so that there was no way she could doze off. Her head ached constantly. She always wanted to vomit. She stopped eating. She made herself miserable. But then all of her options led to misery. She could run away. She could get on a boat and escape to another city. She could run drugs for another opium smuggler. She could, if it came down to it, return to Takani, marry, and hope no one found out that she couldn't have children until it was too late. But the misery she felt now was a good misery. This misery she reveled in, because she had chosen it for herself. 1 month later, Rin tested at the top of one of Jima's frequent linguistics exams. She beat Naja's score by 2 points. When Jima announced the top 5 scores, Rin jerked upright, happily shocked. She had spent the entire night cramming Hesperian verb tenses, which were infinitely confusing. Modern Hesperian was a language that followed neither rhyme nor reason. Its rules were close to pure randomness, its pronunciation guides haphazard and riddled with exceptions. She couldn't reason through Hesperian, so she memorized it, the way she memorized everything she didn't understand.
Good,
Jima said crisply when she handed Rin's exam scroll back to her.
Rin was startled at how good made her feel. She found that she was fueled by praise from her masters. Praise meant that she had finally received validation that she was not nothing. She could be brilliant, could be worth someone's attention. She adored praise, craved it, needed it, and realized she found relief only when she finally had it. She realized, too, that she felt about praise the way that addicts felt about opium. Each time she received a fresh infusion of flattery, she could think only about how to get more of it. Achievement was a high. Failure was worse than withdrawal. Good test scores brought only momentary relief and temporary pride. She basked in her grace period of several hours before she began to panic about her next test. She craved praise so deeply that she felt it in her bones. And just like an addict, she did whatever she could to get it. In the following weeks, Rin clawed her way up from the bottom of the ranks to become one of the top students in each class. She competed regularly with Naja and Venka for the highest marks in nearly every subject. In linguistics, she was second now only to Katai. She particularly enjoyed strategy. Gray-whiskered Master Irja was the first teacher she'd ever had who didn't rely principally on rote memorization as a learning method. He made the students solve logical syllogisms. He made them define concepts they had taken for granted. Concepts like advantage and victory and war. He forced them to be precise and accurate in their answers. He rejected responses that were phrased vaguely or could have multiple interpretations. He stretched their minds, shattered their preconceptions of logic, and then pieced them back together. He gave praise only sparingly, but when he did, he made sure that everyone in the class heard. Rin craved his approval more than anything. Now that they had finished analyzing Sunza's principles of war, Irja spent the second half of class lobbing hypothetical military situations at them, challenging them to think their way out of various quagmires. Sometimes these simulations involved only questions of logistics.
Calculate how much time and how many supplies you need to move a force of this size across this strait.
Other times he drew up maps for them, indicating with symbols how many troops they had to work with, and forced them to come up with a battle plan.
You are stuck behind this river, said Irja. Your troops stand in a prime position for a ranged assault, but your main column has run out of arrows. What do you do?
Most of their class suggested raids on the enemy's weapons carriages. Venka wanted to abandon the ranged idea entirely and pursue a direct frontal assault. Naja suggested they commission the nearby farmers to mass-produce arrows in one night.
Gather scarecrows from the nearby farmers, said Kitai.
Naja snorted.
What? Let him talk, said Irja.
Dress them in spare uniforms, stick them in a boat, and send them downriver,
Kitai continued, ignoring him.
This area is a mountainous region, notorious for heavy precipitation. We can assume it has rained recently, so there should be fog. That makes it difficult for the enemy forces to see the river clearly. Their archers will mistake the scarecrows for soldiers, and shoot until they resemble pincushions. We will then send our men downstream and have them collect the arrows. We use our enemy's arrows to kill our enemies.
Kitai won that one. Another day, Irja presented them with a map of the Wudong Mountain region marked with two red crosses to indicate two Federation battalions surrounding the Nakata army from both ends of the valley.
You're trapped in this valley. The villagers have mostly evacuated, but the Federation general holds a school full of children hostage. He says he will set the children free if your battalion surrenders. You have no guarantee he will honor the terms. How do you respond?
They stared at the map for many minutes. Their troops had no advantage, no easy way out. Even Kitai was puzzled.
Try an assault on the left flank? He suggested. Evacuate the children while they're preoccupied with a small guerrilla force?
They're on higher ground, said Irja. They'll shoot you down before you get the chance to draw your weapons.
Light the valley on fire, Venka tried. Distract them with the smoke?
Good way to burn yourselves to death,
Irja snorted.
Remember, you do not have the high ground.
Rin raised her hand.
Cut around the second army and get onto the dam. Break the dam. Flood the valley. Let everyone inside drown.
Her classmates turned to stare at her in horror.
Leave the children, she added. There's no way to save them.
Naja laughed out loud.
We're trying to win this simulation, idiot.
Irja motioned for Naja to be silent.
Ronin, please elaborate.
It's not a victory either way, said Rin. But if the costs are so high, I would throw all my tiles in. This way they die, and we lose half our troops, but no more. Sun Tzu writes that no battle takes place in isolation. This is just one small move in the grand scheme of the war. The numbers you've given us indicate that these Federation battalions are massive. I'm guessing they constitute a large percentage of the entire Federation army. So, if we give up some of our own troops, we lessen their advantage in all subsequent battles.
You'd rather kill your own people than let the opponent's army walk away,
Irja asked.
Killing isn't the same as letting die, Rin objected.
They're casualties, nonetheless.
Rin shook her head.
You don't let an enemy walk away if they'll certainly be a threat to you later. You get rid of them. If they're that far inland, they know the lay of almost the entire country. They have a geographical advantage. This is our one chance to take out the enemy's greatest fighting force.
Sun Tzu said to always give the enemy a way out,
Irja said. Rin privately thought that this was one of Sun Tzu's stupider principles, but hastily pulled together a counter-argument.
But Sun Tzu didn't mean to let them take that way out. The enemy just has to think the situation is less dire than it is, so they don't grow desperate and do stupid and mutually destructive things.
Rin pondered for a moment.
I suppose they could try to swim.
She's talking about decimating entire villages, Venka protested. You can't just break a dam like that. Dams take years to rebuild. The entire river delta will flood, not just that valley. You're talking about famine, dysentery. You'll mess with the agriculture of the entire region, create a whole host of problems that mean decades of suffering down the line. Problems that can be solved, Rin maintained stubbornly.
What was your solution? To let the Federation walk free into the heartland? That lot of good the agricultural regions will do you when your whole country's been occupied. You would offer up the whole country to them on a platter.
Enough! Enough!
Irja slammed the table to silence them.
Nobody wins this one. You're dismissed for today. Ronin, I want to have a word. My office. Where did you come by this solution?
Irja held up a booklet. Rin recognized her scrawling handwriting at the top. Last week, Irja had assigned them to write essay responses to another simulated quagmire, a counterfactual scenario where the militia had lost popular support for a war of resistance against the Federation. They couldn't rely on peasants to supply soldiers with food or animal feed, could not use peasant homes as lodging without forceful entry. In fact, outbreaks of rebellion in rural areas added several layers of complication to coordinating troop movements. Rin's solution had been to burn down one of the minor island villages. The twist was that the island in question belonged to the Empire.
The first day of Yin's class we talked about how losing Spear ended the Second Poppy War, she said.
Irja frowned.
You based this essay on the Spearly Massacre?
She nodded.
Losing Spear during the Second Poppy War pushed Hesperia over the edge, made them uncomfortable enough that they didn't want Mugen expanding farther into the continent. I thought the destruction of another minor island might do the same for the Nakata population, convince them that the real enemy was Mugen, remind them what the threat was.
Surely militia troops attacking a province of the Empire would send the wrong message,
Irja objected. They wouldn't know it was militia troops, she said. We would pose as a Federation squadron. I suppose I should have been clearer about that in the essay. Better still if Mugen just went ahead and attacked the island for us, but you can't leave these things to chance.
He nodded slowly as he perused her essay.
Crude. Crude, but clever. Do you think that's what happened?
It took her a moment to understand his question. In this simulation? Or during the Poppy Wars?
The Poppy Wars.
Irjao tilted his head, watching her carefully. I'm not entirely sure that's not what happened, Rin said. There's some evidence that the attack on Spira was allowed to succeed.
Irja's expression betrayed nothing, but his fingers tapped thoughtfully against his wooden desk.
Explain.
I find it very difficult to believe that the strongest fighting force in the militia could have been annihilated so easily. That, and the island was suspiciously poorly defended.
What are you suggesting?
Well, I'm not certain, but it seems as if, I mean, maybe someone on the inside, a Nakata general or someone else who was privy to certain information, knew about the attack on Spear but didn't alert anyone.
Now why would we have wanted to lose Spear?
Irja asked quietly. She took a moment to formulate a coherent argument.
Maybe they knew Hesperia wouldn't stand for it. Maybe they wanted to generate popular support to distract from the Red Junk movement. Maybe because we needed a sacrifice, and Spear was expendable in a way other regions weren't. We couldn't let any Nakata die. But Spearlies? Why not?
She had been grasping at straws when she had started to speak, but the moment she said it, her answer sounded startlingly plausible to her. Irja looked deeply uncomfortable.
You must understand that this is a very awkward part of Nikan's history, he said. The way that the Spearlies were treated was regrettable. They were used and exploited by the Empire for centuries. Their warriors were regarded as little more than vicious dogs. Savages. Until Alton came to study at Synegard, I don't believe anyone really thought the Spearlies were capable of sophisticated thought. Nikan does not like to speak of Spear, and for good reason.
Yes, sir. It was just a theory.
Anyhow.
Irja leaned back in his chair.
That isn't all I wanted to discuss. Your strategy in the valley worked for the purposes of the exercise, but no competent ruler would ever give those orders. Do you know why?
She contemplated in silence for a minute.
I confused tactics with grand strategy, she said finally.
Irja nodded.
Elaborate.
The tactic would have worked. We might have even won the war. But no ruler would have chosen that option because the country would have fallen apart afterward. My tactic doesn't grant the possibility of peace.
Why is that?
Irja pressed.
Venka was right about destroying the agricultural heartland. Nikan would suffer famine for years. Rebellions like the Red Junk Opera would spring up everywhere. People would think it was the Empress's fault that they were starving. If we used my strategy, what would happen next is probably a civil war.
Good,
said Irja. He raised his eyebrows.
Very good. You know, you are astoundingly bright.
Rin tried to conceal her delight, though she felt a flutter of warmth spread across her body.
Should you perform well in the trials,
Irja continued,
you might do well as a strategy apprentice.
Under any other circumstances, his words would have thrilled her. Rin managed a resigned smile.
I'm not sure I'll make it that far, sir.
His brow crinkled.
Why's that?
Master Jun kicked me out of his class. I probably won't pass the trials.
How on earth did that happen?
Irja demanded. She recounted her last disastrous class with Jun without bothering to edit the story.
He let Naja off with a suspension,
but told me not to come back.
Ah.
Irja frowned.
Jun didn't punish you because you were brawling. Toby and Alton did far worse than that their first year. He punished you because he's a purist about the school. He thinks any student who isn't descended from a warlord isn't worth his time. But never mind what Jun thinks. You're clever. You'll pick up whatever techniques they covered this month without much trouble.
Rin shook her head. It won't make much difference. He's not letting me back in.
What?
Irja looked outraged.
That's absurd! Does Jima know?
Jima can't intervene in a combat matter. Or won't. I've asked.
Rin stood up.
Thanks for your time, sir. If I make it past the trials, I'd be honored to study with you.
You'll find a way,
Irja said. His eyes twinkled.
Sun Tzu would.
Rin hadn't been completely forthcoming with Irja. He was right. She would find a way. Starting with the fact that she hadn't given up on martial arts. Jun had banned her from his class, but he hadn't banned her from the library. The stacks at Synagard contained a wealth of martial arts instruction tomes, the largest collection in all the Empire. Rin had within reach the secrets of most inherited arts, excepting those tightly guarded techniques like the House of Yin's. In the course of her research, Rin discovered that existing martial arts literature was hugely comprehensive and dauntingly complex. She learned that martial arts revolved largely around lineage. Different forms belonged to different families. Similar techniques taught and improved upon by pupils who had shared the same master. More often than not, schools became torn by rivalries or schisms, so techniques splintered and developed independently of others. The history was deeply enjoyable, almost more entertaining than novels. But practicing the techniques turned out to be devilishly hard. Most tomes were too dense to serve as useful manuals. A majority assumed that the student was reading the book along with a master who could demonstrate the techniques in real life. Others expounded for pages about a certain school's breathing techniques and philosophy of fighting, but only sporadically mentioned things like kicking and punching.
I don't want to read about the balance in the universe, Rin grumbled, tossing aside what seemed like the 100th text she'd tried. I want to know how to beat people up.
She attempted asking the apprentices for help.
Sorry, Kareel said without meeting her eyes. Jun said that teaching first years outside of the practice rooms was against the rules.
Rin doubted this was a real rule, but she should have known better than to ask one of Jun's apprentices. Asking Arda was also not an option. She spent all her time in the infirmary with Enro and never returned to the bunks before midnight. Rin was going to have to teach herself. A month and a half in, she finally found a goldmine of information in the texts of Ha Sijin, quartermaster under the Red Emperor. Sijin's manuals were wonderfully illustrated, filled with detailed descriptions and clearly labeled diagrams. Rin perused the pages gleefully. This was it. This was what she needed.
You can't take this one out,
said the apprentice at the front desk.
Why not?
It's from the restricted shelves,
said the apprentice, as if this were obvious.
First years don't get access to those.
Oh, sorry. I'll take it back.
Rin walked to the back end of the library. She glanced furtively about to make sure no one was watching. She stuffed the tome down her shirt. Then she turned around and walked back out. Alone in the courtyard, book in hand, Rin learned. She learned to shape the air with her fists, to imagine a great spinning ball in her arms to guide the shape of her movements. She learned to root her legs against the ground so she couldn't be tipped over. Not even by opponents twice her weight. She learned to form fists with her thumb on the outside, to always keep her guard up around her face, and to shift her balance quickly and smoothly. She became very good at punching stationary objects. She attended the matches at the rings regularly.
She arrived in the basement early and secured a place by the railing so that she didn't miss a single kick or throw. She hoped that by watching the apprentices fight, she could absorb their techniques. This actually helped, to some extent. By closely examining the apprentices' movements, Rin learned to identify the right place and time for various techniques. When to kick, when to dodge, when to roll madly on the floor to avoid... Wait, no, that was an accident. Jiha had simply tripped. Rin didn't have muscle memory of sparring against another person, so she had to hold these contingencies in her head. But vicarious sparring was better than nothing. She also attended the matches to watch Alton. She would have been lying to herself if she didn't admit that she derived great aesthetic pleasure from staring at him. With his lithe, muscled form and chiseled jawline, Alton was undeniably handsome. But he was also the paragon of good technique. Alton did everything that the Sijin text recommended. He never let his guard down, never allowed an opening, never let his attention slip. He never telegraphed his next move, didn't bounce erratically or go flat on his heels to advertise to his opponent when he was going to kick. He always attacked from angles, never from the front. Rin had initially conceived of Alton as simply a good, strong fighter. Now she could see that he was, in every sense, a genius. His fighting technique was a study in trigonometry, a beautiful composition of trajectories and rebounded forces. He won consistently because he had perfect control of distance and torque. He had the mathematics of fighting down to a science. He fought more often than not. Throughout the semester, his challengers only grew in number. It seemed every single one of Jun's apprentices wanted to have a go at him. Rin watched Alton fight 23 matches before the end of the fall. He never lost. Chapter 6 Winter descended on Synegard with a vengeance. The students enjoyed one last pleasant day of autumn sun, and woke the next morning to find that a cold sheet of snow had fallen over the academy. The snow was lovely to observe for all of 2 serene minutes. Then it became nothing but a pain in the ass. The entire campus turned into a risk zone for broken limbs. The streams froze over. The stairways became slushy and treacherous. Outdoor classes moved indoors. The first years were assigned to scatter salt across the stone walkways at regular intervals to melt the snow, but the slippery paths sent a regular stream of students to the infirmary regardless. As far as lore went, the icy weather was the last straw for most of the class, who had been intermittently frequenting the garden in hopes that Jiang might make an appearance. But waiting around in a drug garden for a never-present teacher was one thing. Waiting in freezing cold temperatures was another. In the months since the semester began, Jiang hadn't shown up once to class. Students occasionally spotted him around campus doing inexcusably rude things. He had in turn flipped Naja's lunch tray out of his hands and walked away whistling, petted Kitai on the head while making a pigeon-like cooing noise, and tried to snip Venka's hair off with garden shears. Whenever a student managed to pin him down to ask about his course, Jiang made a loud farting noise with his mouth and elbow and skirted away. Rin alone continued to frequent the lore garden, but only because it was a convenient place to train. Now that first years avoided the garden out of spite, it was the one place where she was guaranteed to be alone. She was grateful that no one could see her fumbling through the Sijin text. She had picked up the fundamentals with little trouble, but discovered that even just the second form was devilishly hard to put together. Sijin was fond of rapidly twisting footwork. Here the diagrams failed her. The model's feet in the drawings were positioned in completely different angles from picture to picture. Sijin wrote that if a fighter could extricate himself from any awkward placement, no matter how close he was to falling, he would have achieved perfect balance, and therefore the advantage in most combat positions. It sounded good in theory. In practice, it meant a lot of falling over. Sijin recommended pupils practice the first form on an elevated surface,
preferably a thick tree branch or the top of a wall. Against her better judgment, Rin climbed to the middle of the large willow tree overhanging the garden and positioned her feet hesitantly against the bark. Despite Zhang's absence throughout the semester, the garden remained impeccably well-kept. It was a kaleidoscope of garishly bright colors, similar in color scheme to the decorations outside Takani's whorehouses. Despite the cold, the violet and scarlet poppy flowers had remained in full blossom, their leaves trimmed in tidy rows. The cacti, which were twice the size they had been at the start of the term, had been moved into a new set of clay pots, painted in eerie patterns of black and burnt orange. Underneath the shelves, the luminescent mushrooms still pulsed with a faintly disturbing glow, like tiny fairy lamps. Rin imagined that an opium addict could pass entire days in here. She wondered if that was what Zhang did. Poised precariously on the willow tree, struggling to stand up straight against the harsh wind, Rin held the book in one hand, mumbling instructions out loud while she positioned her feet accordingly. Right foot out, pointing straight forward. Left foot back, perpendicular to the straight line of the right foot. Shift weight forward. Lift left foot. She could see why Sijin thought this might be good balance practice. She also saw why Sijin strongly recommended against attempting the exercise alone. She wobbled perilously several times, and regained her balance only after a few heart-stopping seconds of frantic windmilling. Calm down. Focus. Right foot up. Bring it around. Master Jiang walked around the corner, loudly whistling the gatekeeper's touches. Rin's right foot slid out from beneath her. She teetered off the edge of the branch, dropped the book, and would have plummeted to the stone floor if her left ankle hadn't snagged in the crook of two dividing branches. She jolted to a halt with her face inches from the ground and gasped out loud in relief. Zhang stared down silently at her. She gazed back, head thundering while the blood rushed down into her temples. The last notes of his song dwindled and faded away in the howling wind.
"Hello there," he said finally.
His voice matched his demeanor, placid, disengaged, and idyllically curious. In any other context, it might have been soothing. Rin struggled ungracefully to haul herself upward.
"Are you all right?"
he asked.
"I'm stuck," she mumbled.
Appears so."
He clearly wasn't going to help her down. Rin wriggled her ankle out of the branch, tumbled to the floor, and landed in a painful heap at Zhang's feet. Cheeks burning, she clambered to her feet and brushed the snow off her uniform.
"Elegant," Zhang remarked.
He tilted his head very far to the left, studying her intently as if she were a particularly fascinating specimen. Up close, Zhang looked even more bizarre than Rin had first thought. His face was a riddle. It was neither lined with age nor flushed with youth, but rather invulnerable to time, like a smooth stone. His eyes were a pale blue color she had never seen on anyone in the Empire.
"Bit daring, aren't you?"
He sounded like he was suppressing laughter.
"Do you often dangle from trees?"
"You startled me, sir."
He puffed air through his cheeks like a little child.
"You're your just pet pupil, aren't you?"
Her cheeks flushed. I don't...
"You are."
He scratched his chin and scooped her book off the ground, riffling through its pages with a mild curiosity.
"Dusky little peasant prodigy, you. He can't stop raving about you."
She shuffled her feet, wondering where this was going. Had that been a compliment? Was she supposed to thank him? She tucked a lock of hair back behind her ear.
Oh, don't pretend to be bashful. You love it."
Zhang glanced casually down at the book and gazed back up at her.
"What are you doing with the Sijin text?"
"I found it in the archives."
"Oh, I take that back. You're not daring. You're just stupid."
When Rin looked confused, Zhang explained.
Jun explicitly forbade Sijin until at least your second year.
She hadn't heard this rule. No wonder the apprentice hadn't let her sign the book out of the archives.
Jun expelled me from his class. I wasn't informed.
Jun expelled you, Jiang repeated slowly. She couldn't tell if he was amused or not.
What on earth did you do to him?
Tackled another student during sparring, sort of. He started it, she added quickly. The other student, I mean.
Jiang looked impressed.
Stupid and hot-headed.
His eyes wandered over to the plants on the shelf behind her. He walked around her, lifted a poppy flower up to his nose, and sniffed experimentally. He made a face. He dug around in the deep pockets of his robes, fished out a pair of shears, then clipped the stem and tossed the broken end into a pile in the corner of a garden. Rin began to inch toward the gate. Perhaps if she left now, Jiang would forget about the book.
I'm sorry if I shouldn't be in here.
Oh, you're not sorry. You're just annoyed I interrupted your training session, and you're hoping I'll leave without mentioning your stolen book.
Jiang snipped another stem off the poppy plant.
You're a plucky one, you know that. Got banned from June's class, so you thought you'd teach yourself Sijin.
He made several syncopated wheezing noises. It took Rin a moment to realize he was laughing.
What's so funny? She demanded. Sir, if you're going to report me, I just want to say—
Oh, I'm not going to report you. What fun would that be?
He was still chuckling.
Were you really trying to learn Sijin from a book? Do you have a death wish?
It's not that hard, she said defensively. I just followed the pictures.
He turned back toward her. His expression was one of amused disbelief. He opened the book, riffled through the pages with a practiced hand, and then stopped on the page detailing the first form. He brandished the book at her.
That one.
Do that.
Rin obliged. It was a tricky form, full of shifting movements and ball-change steps. She squeezed her eyes shut as she moved. She couldn't concentrate in full sight of those luminous mushrooms, those bizarrely pulsing cacti. When she opened her eyes, Jiang had stopped laughing.
You're nowhere near ready for Sijin, he said.
He slammed the book shut with one hand.
Jun was right. At your level, you shouldn't even be touching this text.
Rin fought a wave of panic. If she couldn't even use the Sijin text, she might as well leave for Takani right now. She had found no other books that were half as useful or as clear.
You might benefit from some animal-based fundamentals,
Jiang continued. Yinmen's work.
He was Sijin's predecessor. Have you heard of him?
She glanced up at him in confusion. I've looked for those. Those scrolls are incomplete.
Of course you won't be learning from scrolls,
Jiang said impatiently.
We'll discuss this in class tomorrow.
Class? You haven't been here all semester.
Jiang shrugged.
I find it difficult to bother myself with first years I don't find particularly interesting.
Rin thought this was just irresponsible teaching, but she wanted to keep Jiang talking. Here he was in a rare moment of lucidity, offering to teach her martial arts that she couldn't learn by herself. She was half afraid that if she said the wrong thing, she would send him running off like a startled hare.
So am I interesting?
She asked slowly.
You're a walking disaster,
Jiang said bluntly.
You're training with arcane techniques at a rate that will lead to inevitable injury, and not the kind you recover from. You've misinterpreted Sijin's texts so badly that I believe you've come up with a new art form all by yourself.
Rin scowled.
Then why are you helping me?
Despite Jun, mostly.
Jiang scratched his chin.
I hate the man. Did you know he petitioned to have me fired last week?
Rin was mostly surprised that Jun hadn't tried that sooner.
Also, anyone this obstinate deserves some attention, if only to make sure you don't become a walking hazard to everyone around you.
Jiang continued.
You know, your footwork is remarkable.
She flushed.
Really?
Placement is perfect. Beautiful angles.
He cocked his head.
Of course, everything you're doing is useless.
She scowled. Well, if you're not going to teach me, then...
I didn't say that. You've done a good job working only with the text.
Zhang acknowledged.
A better job than many apprentices would have done. It's your upper body strength that's the problem. Namely, you have none.
He grabbed for her wrist and pulled her arm up as if he were examining a mannequin.
So skinny. Weren't you a farmhand or something?
Not everyone from the South is a farmer, she snapped. I was a shop girl.
No heavy labor, then. Pampered. You're useless.
She crossed her arms against her chest. I wasn't pampered.
Yeah.
He held up a hand to cut her off.
It doesn't matter. Here's the thing. All the technique in the world won't do you any good if you don't have the strength to back it up. You don't need Sijin, kid. You need ki. You need muscle.
So what do you want me to do? Calisthenics? He stood still, contemplative for a long moment. Then he beamed.
No, I have a better idea. Be at the campus gates for class tomorrow.
Before she could respond, he strolled out of the garden.
Wow.
Raban set down his chopsticks.
He must really like you.
He called me stupid and hot-headed, Rin said. And then he told me to be on time for class.
He definitely likes you, Raban said. Zhang's never uttered anything nice to anyone in my year. He mostly yells at us to stay away from his daffodils. He told Kareel that her braids made her look like snakes were growing out the back of her head. I heard he got drunk on rice wine last week and pissed into June's window.
Kitai chipped in.
He sounds awesome!
How long has Zhang been here? Rin asked. The lore master seemed amazingly young, at most half of June's age. She couldn't believe the other masters would put up with such aggravating behavior from someone who was clearly their junior.
Not sure. He was here when I was a first year, but that doesn't mean much. I heard he came from the Night Castle 20 years ago.
Zhang was psych? Among the divisions of the militia, only the psych bore an ill reputation. They were a division of soldiers holed up in the Night Castle, far up the Wudong mountain range, whose sole task was to carry out assassinations for the Empress. The Psyche fought without honor. They respected no rules of combat, and they were notorious for their brutality. They operated in the darkness. They did the Empress's dirty work and received no recognition afterward. Most apprentices would have quit the service rather than join the Psyche. Rin had a hard time reconciling her image of the whimsical lore master with that of a hardened assassin.
Well, that's just the rumor. None of the masters will say anything about him. I get the feeling that Zhang's considered a bit of an embarrassment to the school.
Raban rubbed the back of his head.
The apprentices love to gossip, though. Every class plays the Who is Zhang guessing game. My class was convinced that he was the founder of the Red Junk Opera. The truth's been stretched so many times that the only thing certain is that we know absolutely nothing about him.
Surely he's had apprentices before, said Rin.
Zhang is the lore master, Raban said slowly, as if talking to a child. Nobody pledges lore.
Because Zhang won't take any students?
Because lore is a bloody joke, said Raban. Every other track at Synagard prepares you for a government position or for command in the militia. But lore is... I don't know, lore's odd. I think it was originally meant to be a study of the Hinterlanders, to see if there's any substance to their witch magic rituals, but everyone lost interest pretty quickly. I know Yim and Sonnen have both petitioned Jimon to have the class cancelled, but it's still offered every year. I'm not sure why.
Surely there have been lore students in the past, said Kitai.
What have they said?
Raban shrugged.
It's a new discipline. The others have been taught since the Red Emperor founded this school, but lore's only been around for 2 decades or so, and no one's stuck with the course all the way through. I hear that a couple years ago some suckers took the bait, but they dropped out of Synagard and were never heard from again. No one in their right mind now would pledge lore. Alton was the exception, but nobody ever knows what's going on in Alton's head. I thought Alton pledged strategy,
said Kitai.
Alton could have pledged whatever.